Welcome to Uncle Form Podcast. This is a 30-ish minute podcast created by Darius Watkins and Ryan Thomas. We are two black males discussing the intersections between faith and culture. So join us on this ride while we chop it up for the next 30-ish minutes.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Ryan. Just want to give a little bit of a trigger warning. We will be talking about some sensitive topics today regarding sex trafficking, human trafficking, things along those lines. So because we have a YouTube channel and there's some words that we can't say on there, SA will be the term we use to refer to sexual assault or rape or things along those lines, just so that we don't get flagged on YouTube. So if you hear us say SA, that's what we mean. I hope everybody enjoys this episode. And we are live. So today on Uncle Form Podcast, we are here. Darius and I are here with a friend of mine named Whitney Trotter. Whitney has worked in a plethora of different fields regarding, you know, SA. She's been working in other fields of endeavors that she's going to tell us about. But I did want to give her an introduction worthy of a woman who is as great and mighty as she is. She was one of the Memphis 30 under 30 back in 2000 and I think what 14
I think so I can't remember 2014 2015
maybe 30 yeah. Under 30
so many awards, man. She can't even keep up with them, right? It's just like, you know,
she can't remember the years, she can't remember the awards. It's just all a blur. But we are here with the great Whitney Trotter. How you doing, Whitney?
Good. I'm so excited to be here with y'all. I'm really excited to get to chat and, yeah, do all the things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you don't mind, could you tell the people a little bit about yourself? I will say that she is the wife of a regular on the show. He's been on twice, at least. Jeff Trotter's wife.
Been on once. But it's
he's
cool.
Been on twice, man. He's talking about Dolph the second time. You sure? Okay.
Yes. One time. But it's cool, though. They equal now.
But Whitney, tell us about yourself. Tell us about yourself.
Yes, I'm married to Jeff Trotter, easily my favorite person in the whole world. We have a lot of fun going on. It'll be 10 years. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Married. I know it's gone by so fast. We have a very wild and spunky 6-year-old named McKinley. And what else? Okay. So I'm a nurse, dietitian, and getting ready to graduate with my doctorate to be a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So I'm finishing up my last, this is like my last big clinical year. So
awesome.
A lot of training, and I'm one of the four co-founders for Restore Core, which is a Memphis-based anti-trafficking nonprofit. And then I have my own private practice where I specialize in treating people with eating disorders.
Awesome. That's awesome. And we are talking about some things that you've done at Restore Corps. That would be the topic that we're most interested in getting more information about today. There's so much that I think we don't know about when it comes to trafficking. And yeah. I thought it would be great just to get some information on, you know, some things to look for, you know, how to recognize victims, and then maybe some steps people can take if they, you know, see suspicious activity around them.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we can just jump right in, you know, I was actually watching an episode of The Chi. The Chi is a TV show that a lot of people like about Chicago. And they had this one episode where this character named Amani was doing a woman's hair in her shop. And the woman was just looking very uneasy, very nervous. And a man had brought her in there to get her hair done. And, you know, he was just being really disrespectful. And the man left. So when the man left, Imani asked her, like, are you okay? And she started crying. She's like, no. So Imani tried to go on this rescue mission to rescue the woman and get her out of trafficking because she had been trafficked. So my first question is, how do you identify, how do we identify a possible victim of trafficking?
That's a great question. It's probably one of the number one questions that we get asked. And I'll say this, full disclosure, I don't work with victims as much as I used to. I used to do direct, like, help with victim services, just season of life. I do more of the medical training, how to help community members, medical, first responders identify trafficking victims. And the hard part is like a trafficking victim is rarely going to self-present and say that somebody is forcing me to have sex for money.
Yeah.
Particularly in a city like Memphis, right? So just like how you described with the shy, it's really some of those nonverbal cues of picking up on if somebody is hypervigilant, if somebody appears like very distressed, if they are saying certain things, even sometimes kind of behaving erratically, it's always warranted to ask, like, are you safe? Clinically, how I train providers is to always ask the question, have you ever had to exchange sex for food, clothing, water, or shelter? The reason why that's so important in a city like Memphis is you think about all the poverty we have here.
Yeah,
and if you think about all the cities that are within 6 hours, what are they? New Orleans, Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas. All of those cities are huge trafficking cities as well. And Memphis is in the middle of all of those. So, you know, one of the big myths about trafficking is it's always international people. And when you live in a state like Tennessee, we're landlocked, most of our trafficking victims are domestic. And so I remember one year, Rachel and I, this is probably 7 or 8 years ago. I think one summer we were getting people from Milwaukee. I mean, being trafficked on buses, like it was the wildest summer, in terms of what we were seeing trafficking wise. And a lot of people give me flack for saying this. People will disagree. I don't really care, but think about our culture, right? And you think about Memphis, we like 3-6 Mafia literally won a Grammy for what song? We sing it at the Memphis Grizzlies, right?
Like, oh, man.
Whoop that trick, right? And it's so interesting because one of the ways that we see particularly young Black girls trafficked is that they are promised modeling contracts. Or they're promised to be in videos. They're promised, you know. And so it's very interesting when you look at the connection of hip hop culture, rap culture, and trafficking, specifically with young Black girls.
Wow.
Yeah. And like you say about Memphis, and like most people probably don't even, most people who are listening who aren't really born in a city or like hadn't been around a city for a long time. They don't even know that, like, people call Memphis, like, they say Memphis stands for making easy money, pimping hoes and style. Like, that's literally what they say Memphis stands for.
Wow.
So, like, so just, like, and you think about things, like, you
I never heard that.
About, like, I wasn't going to say your name directly, but I was definitely thinking about you. But with that being said, like, that's definitely, like, a thing. And it's almost, like, infiltrated into the Memphis culture. But for you, I'm wondering, like, what made you, during that season of life, like, get involved in the area?
What made me, gosh, I've been doing trafficking for so long. So I originally went to school because I wanted to work in HIV. So I was a college athlete and wanted to study HIV. I didn't realize that HIV and AIDS was so prominent in the States. I just assumed I was going to go work internationally. And then I was afforded an opportunity to study at St. Jude, which has one of the best child and adolescent HIV clinics, in my opinion, in the world. So I started noticing in younger, like probably younger adolescents, just that were HIV positive, just the influx of how many of them were having sex with older people. And some of that was not by their choice. And so I connected with Rachel. She was telling me a little bit about what she was doing human trafficking wise. Had never even heard of human trafficking at that point. Didn't know it existed. and then just really got involved. And then I just really started seeing, I was like, dang, we, not only is trafficking happening in the United States, it's happening in Memphis, and literally no one is talking about it. I mean, you, again, you think about it every once in a while, it cycles with the, on the news, but you think about how many young kids of color, Black, Brown, and Indigenous young kids go missing in the U.S.
That's so true. I mean, even, you know, to finish up what happened in the Shy, you know, after she reached out to the young girl about what was going on, she set up a time to meet her later. She slid her a burner phone when she was away from her abuser. The abuser found the phone and he ended up killing her, you know? So like, so my next question is just like, how do you do this dangerous work, you know, and keep yourself safe while trying to, you know, help someone else? And then also, how do you keep them safe? You know, it just seems like such a tricky equation to figure out when, with the danger involved with something like this.
Yeah, you know, I was very naive starting. I don't think I really thought about, like, safety awareness. You know, my husband. And so it didn't dawn on me the safety risk. Again, because when Rachel and I and Brian and Stephanie, like, we were in our 20s, like, I mean, this was like 12 years ago, right? So there was nobody helping us. No, like, churches weren't really supporting us. You know, people weren't really taking human trafficking seriously. Literally, by the grace of God, there were two FBI agents, two Black female FBI agents in Memphis who, like, literally took us under their wings. And we got to go to Nashville and do, like, a big statewide TBI human trafficking training. And then got to work with the FBI here and then started working with local law enforcement. So I think because of those relationships, I always felt safe. And it wasn't like, we knew very on, like, we're not vigilantes, right? Like, I'm not running and chasing nobody, knocking on no doors, you know? Like, you got to use common sense. I also, you know, dating somebody that was living in the mound. And, like, Jeff was always with me. Even when we were dating and I was working at our local SA center, you know, I would have to go in at like 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and like, I would call him and he, you know, would come pick me up, or he would come back to my apartment with me, you know, things like that, which was like, definitely in our Christianese bubble, not happening. So I always had him if, you know, anything popped off, and he was just always really around. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I definitely took for granted early on, because a lot of people don't have that. I would say that. I would say it definitely doesn't come without paranoia. You know, I have a 6-year-old little girl. I started teaching her things, like, probably when we started, like, potty training her, just because you see so much, right? Like, I've been doing this for 12 years. Like, Rachel and I started at our SA center in the middle of the night, actually doing interviews while we were waiting on forensic exams to be done. So it definitely doesn't come without, like, the vicarious trauma, but I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah, for sure. I think it does. And I think that, like, obviously, like, we're talking about Memphis, and I think it's important to, like, talk about, like, national conversations too, but also, like, related to Memphis a little bit. So, like, the most recent incident that we could think about that was, like, national news was, Liza Fletcher, the runner in Memphis who was kidnapped and whatnot, believed to be essayed. In that, I think that people kind of, like, I think that the majority of people was like, you know, this is great. It's great that we're using our resources in this way. It's great that we're finding things out so quickly. But as you talk about Black women, like, how does it kind of make you feel, like, when you see, like, one side get, like, one treatment and then, like, the other side, like, on milk cartons for months, years, decades even? Like, talk about that a little bit.
That's a good question.
I think it's hard because there is this, like, okay, trafficking in this country has been happening, right, since 1619, right? Like, the foundation of the foundation of what this country, you know, was built on when you think about colonialism was trafficking of bodies. And it was trafficking of Black bodies. So there is this presumption that it is okay to traffic Black and Brown bodies. And what is interesting is I remember there was an older white couple that moved into Orange Mound. And y'all know this, back in the day when white people were flooding, like North Memphis, Binghamton, Orange Mound, right? I distinctly remember a white couple telling me that there was a trafficker that moved to Collierville, and the people of Collierville, like, they were basically like, we're not having this. And I was like, that is so interesting. One, the privilege to be able to just say that and do something about it. But two, what happens is, there's an assumption that Black and Brown people don't care that our kids are being trafficked, and that's not true. But two, the media, right? The media is not going to, if you have somebody like Eliza, who is blonde, who comes from a fluent family, they're going to make it pull on your heartstrings versus a young 15-year-old Black girl that might be bipolar or having some mental health issues that runs away from home that gets trafficked.
Right.
And so you see it play out in the media a lot. And a lot of times, you know, you have to think too, the resources, right? Like, does the family have the resources to put the pressure on law enforcement that needs to happen to keep the case active?
Not usually, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's so funny you bring up mental health, because I think that's like a huge gap, like in understanding like what's going on a lot of times in like impoverished communities, because you don't think about that. Like, I have a kid in my school who, I'm a school counselor, by the way, but I have a kid in my school who hears voices and stuff in her head, and they gave her medicine for ADHD. So like, even like, if something were to happen to that kid, you know what I'm saying? If something were to happen to that kid, then like, she could tell the police that this kid has ADHD, but like, that's it. You know what I'm saying? They can't say that this kid is bipolar or schizophrenic or anything like that, just because of the lack of resources or the lack of accessibility to a lot of resources. So like, it's interesting you bring that up, and like how that ultimately ends up playing like a huge role in things, whether it matters with sympathy or compassion or understanding, whatever the case may be. Like, those secondary issues, and sometimes you can even call them primary issues, like, don't necessarily get advocated in the same way for or portrayed in the same way. So,
100%. And you see this again in Memphis and the disparity, right? Because how many of our kids going to Memphis City schools are dealing with trauma at home, are dealing with people getting shot, getting people getting stabbed? I mean, I was an ER nurse at Lebanon for years, and these kids would, brothers and sisters would come in there. Somebody was having an asthma attack. Somebody had a gunshot wound and had to go to school the next day, right? What happens at our private schools? These kids are shipped off to luxury places, right? I see it all the time in eating disorders. If you have the financial access, guess what? You're going inpatient to a private eating disorder facility out of state. It usually looks like a mansion, and you have round the clock care. That is not happening to our kids that go to schools in Memphis City schools, that go to our public schools. We can't even, like you said, we can't even get the medication.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, talking about poverty, you know, a lot of what I think about as I was thinking about this topic is like, people actually depending on the person that's committing the essay, you know, like for food and shelter and clothing, like they need them for their base needs. So like, have you ever run into a situation where there's someone that kind of like desires to get out of the situation, but they don't feel like they can because they need this person to feed them and clothe them and house them? And are there any like ways to like mitigate, you know, or like build a bridge for them to get out in that scenario?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So kind of what you're describing is called grooming. We see that a lot of times with older men. They will groom their victims, even young boys. And so they will groom them and create this sense of like, there's the person who's being trafficked, their survival is dependent on the trafficker or the pimp. Right. So they are, it's, you know, kind of Stockholm syndrome, right? So this person becomes dependent on them and cannot exist or survive without them.
Right.
So we definitely see that a lot. It's very hard when you are groomed that way, or, you know, let's say, for example, you know, you have a young girl, and I'm saying girl, you know, trafficking definitely happens to young boys. And it's something we don't talk about a lot, particularly young Black boys, because there's a lot of shame. But I've worked just as many eating disorder, SA cases, trafficking with young boys as young girls.
Wow.
But let's say you have a young girl who the mom's boyfriend was, you know, committing SA. She runs. She already has that type of trauma, right? And it was already in her home unit. So think about how much easier it's going to be for somebody to come and groom her, right? So they're usually going to say, you know, hey, you can come stay with me, or I'll take you to school, or I'll give you this, you know, I'll buy you these shoes, X, Y, and Z. And you start that grooming process. And then you're solely dependent on that person. So there's so you bring a great point. There's so many misconceptions on how trafficking starts. I mean, we've had people that ended up being victims of trafficking because I'm thinking of one client in particular, their grandmother had cancer and they were trying to pay the bills. And we've had people that have had seizure disorder, you know, formula, right? Could not feed their baby, and they loved their baby so much. And that's how they ended up, you know, being a victim of trafficking.
Yeah. And that's so heavy. And like you did this for a season, and obviously, like, or at least I don't believe that you would have done it the whole time if every single case that came to you was a failure. So maybe can you talk about like some success stories if that happened?
I don't know that we get to see it. It's hard to see the measure success in like cyclic trauma that we see. But one of the things I'm the proudest about, and Rachel really spearheaded this several years ago, we got to do like we got to go undercover with Vice, so to speak. And so there was one lieutenant, he was like this older white man, and he was very good at his job, but he ran the Vice unit, and he was like, I just keep picking up the same people. People that were just walking the track that, you know, were engaging in commercial sexual exploitation. And he was like, I'm tired of picking up the same people. What can we do? And so that conversation led to us at Restore Corps and the DA's office. We actually, in Vice, we started a program called Lives Worth Saving. And so it is the second Thursday of every month at Calvary Episcopal. And what we do is any person that is charged for prostitution, but it's really commercial exploitation, they can come down there, and there's people that will help them get their GED. We have a safe house now. There's STD. There's so many community services. And what it does is it reduces their bond. And it goes, you know, we can present that to the judge and say, hey, they came and took our class. The DA's office is willing to sign up on it. So it's a really good way when we think about harm reduction and to how to reduce people having to continue to go back out into the street. So that's one of the things I'm really, really like most proud of us. We also have the safe house, where we actually can house, survivors, but there's a lot of really good stories too. A lot of families have been able to be reunited. A lot of moms have been able to go through the process and get custody of their kids back.
Good.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And do you think that, I know you're not actively involved with Restore Corps right now, but do you think that dating sites and social media has like been used to lure victims in more over the years? Because, you know, over the course of the last 10, 12 years, we're living in a whole different world when it comes to that.
Oh, 100%. We can't even keep up. We can't even keep up. And, you know, Backpage is huge. Again, like Rachel and I mean, we got to go on like plenty of undercover operations with the FBI. They would do kind of operation cross country. And the majority of those were from dating apps, but not dating apps, I'm sorry, where people were posting people online to sell through Backpage.
Wow.
And so that was a good majority of how victims were found is through the online selling of them.
Wow.
I tell my parents, you know, you need to be, technology is good, and it also can be a gateway to a lot of dangerous things.
Yeah, and I think that as you mentioned that, like, you talk about, like, the rise of social media, like, that's definitely played a role. But I think, like, something that's, like, also, like, not necessarily considered is, like, the sites, like, I mean, just, like, the porn sites and, like, the OnlyFans type sites and stuff like that. It's, like, actually, like, you would think that, like, conventional wisdom would tell you, like, a significant majority of them are probably being trafficked. And they're probably not even, like, seeing, like, the money themselves. And I think that that's, like, kind of lost amongst this conversation because, like, everybody wants to talk about, like, liberation and equality and things like that. But, like, the very thing that you're supporting, and you may think that it's liberation, you may think that it's helping these women or men in these situations, like, it's actually, like, leading to a detriment and only, like, leading to more trafficking at a higher level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we used to have, back in the day, I mean, it was so, so sick and sad, but there would be like owners and managers of strip clubs that would recruit kids getting ready to age out of the foster care system. Wow. Because once you age out of the foster, where do you go? Mm-hmm. We have nothing in Memphis for kids that are about to age out of the foster care system, you know?
Mm.
So I always say, you know, trafficking is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it is not a multi-billion dollar industry because traffickers are stupid, right? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because when I think about traffickers, I think about some of the scum of the earth, most evil people that exist. You know what I mean? But and you know, that's likely true, but it's also so widely spread. It's almost shocking to me.
Yeah.
Like where it's like, oh, that's got to be something that doesn't happen very often, because people aren't just that evil, are they? They're not just. But you know, that's the tricky thing about it. I was actually had a friend of mine. I think Darius, you saw this on social media too, but a friend of mine posted about a woman who was at the store and a white van pulled up, and you know, they pulled up behind her car. It was the middle of the day, and you know, the guy approached her and everything, trying to get her to get in the van or something. Did you see that post, Darius?
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah. And it was just like the audacity of it is strong. Like, you know, there's like a level of boldness to even do something like that. And I think, you know, it's easy to kind of like be ignorant to what's going on if you're not being kind of vigilant in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sad you have to be hyper vigilant. Like, it's sad that, like, but you have to, you know, like, you really have to be so hyper vigilant these days.
Yeah. That's why I don't like when kids are on social media, actually. I think they should wait until 17, 18, at least.
Agreed.
Yeah, speaking of being hyper-vigilant, I can think about this one time. A family member of mine, a friend, family member, whatever you want to call this person, ran away from home. This person was a teenager. This person was a girl. This person was on social media, or the police department had, like, posted this person's picture on social media. And somebody hit me up and was like, hey, we seen this person on Lamar. And you know, like, that's like one of the things where, like, it's social media. Like, I don't know this person or whatever. But they know that, like, I'm close to this family, so on and so forth. And I'm like, the chances of this person actually, like, being on Lamar, it's probably slim to none, but you still got to do the work. You still got to go to Lamar. So I drive to Lamar. It's like broad daylight. And I'm looking around, like, and I see, like, these beat up hotels, these beat up motels, all this stuff. And it's like, man, this is like a hotbed for trafficking. But like, you only really think in that way, typically, unless you're vigilant and unless something's happened for you to like be in that mindset of like, I'm looking for potential trafficking. So like, my question to you is like, how does the normal person like begin to look for signs of trafficking?
That's such a good question, because it's We are conditioned to think it's only people in cages or walking the track. Mm-hmm. And I cannot, you being a school counselor, I cannot tell you how many kids are currently being trafficked and still going to school. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. And so it's not, you cannot look at somebody and know if they are being trafficked or mm-hmm. SA,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And we know that there is a high percentage, if you already have a history of SA, it increases the likelihood that you could potentially become a victim of trafficking. Mm-hmm. Right. And so again, I think asking those questions, I think, you know, again, I do so much of the medical, so I'm trying not to be so medically minded in my answers, but, you know, I think two young Black girls in particular, very over-sexualized in puberty. Mm-hmm. Our bodies do not go through puberty the same as our white counterparts or even our Asian counterparts. Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, Black and Latina girls, there's an over-sexualization. Mm-hmm. And so even having those conversations when that happens is, are you being safe? Is somebody, you know, if you see them, an older man, and when I say older, if somebody is 11, you know, 16 is too old, right? If they're getting mm-hmm. a lot of attention from somebody that's 16, 17, 18, 21, having that conversation with them, mm-hmm. if they're constantly coming to school with new clothes on, new shoes, asking them about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think those are ways to definitely be involved. There's a lot of young girls that are in gangs now, particularly where we live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with gang initiation season, it's always hard because you're going to increase the risk of potential for trafficking and potential for SA. And also, we always assume that traffickers are men. There are a lot of female traffickers yep. out there.
Mm-hmm. Never would have thought that one. Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, honestly, never thought about it. You know what I mean? But that is a good point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I heard when you're in the like impoverished part of town or like what we call the hood, when you're dealing with kids in the hood, their age, you need to take their age and add 5 years in order to understand the level of maturity and development that they're at.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, it's like working. Okay, so I was in New York City for a conference and there was a 5-year-old. First of all, I was walking around lost because I was like, I don't know how I'm about to get on the subway. Like I was like literally just like on Google Maps trying to figure out. There was a 5-year-old, y'all, that was getting on the subway by himself for school.
Oh, no.
Because that is how, I mean, you know what I'm saying? If you, people don't have cars, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. If mom and dad are working,
yeah,
you got 3 or 4 subways. So you think about that, but change that to Memphis, the Memphis mentality, right? So again, if mom and dad are working 2 to 3 jobs to be able to provide, you know, ends meet, usually the 7, 8, 9-year-old is what? Taking care of the younger kids, mm-hmm. right? Or, yeah. And so you think about that level of what it, that type of trauma, what it does to the brain, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. also it does make kids grow up, not developmentally appropriately, but right. just their life experience in a way that is so hazardous and how they communicate and what they see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like a weathering that happens to them prematurely. Mm-hmm. You're weathered and you're, yeah.
Yeah, so like I feel like this is something that like when you talk about the church, when you talk about Christianity, and when you talk about like the different sects of Christianity and stuff like that, when I say mm-hmm. sex, I said S-E-C-T-S.
C-T-S.
To be clear. But but with that, like you got all these branches of Christianity and stuff like this. Like this seems like something that like could be like the Christianity, like unity and bullying pulpit basically, but it's mm-hmm. not really mm-hmm. like why do you think that is?
I'm gonna try to answer this as diplomatic as I can since my husband currently works at or a church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church, the Southern Evangelical Church, thrived during slavery. It's not mm-hmm. shocking to me that it thrives also during human trafficking, right? Think about the churches, Calvary Episcopal, right? Even though they housed the lives worth saving, right? They were around during what? during human segregation, you know, and so literally during the enslavement of bodies, like churches, you know what I'm saying? Churches like have, so it's not shocking to me that the church continues to stay silent. I think the thing is, again, is there is this like notion that it is normal for people to own black and brown bodies. Complicit during slavery, you know, they have to acknowledge when they have to acknowledge that, right, and all the harm that has gotten done. But you also think too, I think it's hard for churches. Sometimes we live in this like naive Pleasantville and we don't want to have hard conversations. And so how do you talk about human trafficking without talking about sex and sexual exploitation? The church really doesn't do that, you know?
That's crazy. That is I like the way you connected those two things together, because when the normalization of one evil creates a normalization of another, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, listen, like this has been, I mean, and that's what's so interesting. Like think about the Bible, right? Rahab. Why do we never tell the story of Rahab and everything she went through from a trafficking perspective? Right. If you think about the age, if you think about her being near the wall, right, and it's symbolic to what we talk about the track, right? You think about all that.
I never thought about that.
And that's a great point. But for people who are listening who may not necessarily be up on the Old Testament and whatnot, could you give like a
brief... hope everybody knows the story right now.
Maybe you could just like summarize it just briefly.
Okay, yeah. So yes, Rahab, one of my favorite people in the Bible to study, was considered, you know, would have been a prostitute at her time. I think also we assume a lot of people in the Bible are older than what they are. You know, people were considered women, young girls were considered women 12, 13 when they started their cycle, right? So probably wasn't 30 or 40, right? So a young person having to provide for her family by sexually exploiting herself, which was very common at the time. You know, the spies came and my Bible trivia is off. And so the red, my word, it's been a long day.
She had the red scarf or thing that she hung out the window.
And so just the symbolism of that as well, you know, just with the color red and how symbolic that is. And so again, you know, we think about her being at the wall, which is back in that time was such a high traffic area. And that is how she would get quote unquote customers.
Easy access.
Right. And so we think about that redemption story. You know, it's, wow. Yeah, it's very symbolic to what we see today, but we as the church don't view it as that, you know?
Yeah,
she's actually celebrated in that she did hide the spies of Israel when Joshua was coming to seek out the city. She hid them and God, you know, blessed her for that. So
she's in the lineage.
Yeah.
That's right. She's one of the relatives of the ancestors of Jesus. So
yeah. And I think that like the Bible shows how much God hates trafficking and how much God hates SA. When you think about Judges and the concubine woman. That's Judges 19 ? You got a Bible near you, Whitney?
I'm a bad pastor's wife. It's bad. Do better listen.
It's all good. But it's Judges 19. You got a situation to where these men rape SA, this woman, all hours of the night. And this person is eventually killed, and the Levite is angry about it. And what he does is that he breaks her limbs into pieces and sends it to all people to show what's happened. And like when you think about the Bible, you can think about 2 Timothy 3:16. It says all scriptures useful for teaching, correcting, training, and rebuking in righteousness. If there was an author or a group of authors in the Bible, you would think that they would have left that out. Because mm-hmm. it's no good ending to that story. It's just no good ending to that story at all.
Yeah, it's terrible, terrible.
But like, because these people are inspired by God, it's God breathed, like God chose to put that in the Bible. And this mm-hmm. person who we don't even know her name, her legacy lives forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like, even yeah. in the midst of like something terrible happened, like God chose to put that in the Bible. So that's all. Yeah. This yeah. like the only encouragement I can find, like from that whole section in Judges 19. But yeah. with that being,
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've always asked Jeff, I'm like, why is this in there? Like, why mm-hmm. do you think we have debated back and forth like mm-hmm. for 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought of that from that perspective, because that's one of the pieces of the Bible that you don't see any redemption in, right? Like mm-hmm. Rahab, mm-hmm. like we see the redemption in her, you know, we see the redemption. Right.
Mary Magdalene.
In Mary Magdalene, we see the redemption in even Ruth, right? Mm-hmm. Because if God didn't send Boaz, right, who was the son of Rahab, you could, I mean, you think, I always, when I used to teach about trafficking from a biblical perspective, right, mm-hmm. there is no Ruth without Rahab, because Rahab, or, you know, Ruth is when we think about prevention, the young girls that we want to prevent going into
trafficking,
right?
Ooh, that's
but
good.
If there was no Boaz from Rahab, right, Ruth is trafficked,
mm-hmm.
because how, again, how do you provide for yourself?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. you know, you think about that, and just that's the how the longevity of trafficking has been able to evolve, is because if you cannot, you know, again, it wasn't until 1970s that women could even open up a bank account without a man's name on it.
Facts.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And so women have always had to figure out a way to survive. And sometimes it's through the use of the exploitation of their bodies.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, so let's
say, and in a way, you made me just realize, like, in a way, you've been Naomi for some women
mm-hmm.
in their life.
Yeah.
And like, Naomi did such a service to Ruth, because like you said, there's limited options for someone like Ruth back in that day.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's necessarily always a moral choice, or like a choice of immorality, like I'm just gonna sin, I wanna sin. Like, no, it's like women are usually doing this for like practical reasons and survival based reasons. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
So it's not like evil for evil's sake. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. If the church really did what God commanded us to do, excuse me, of learning, of taking care of the orphans and the widows, would we have the foster care crisis that we have, and would we have the trafficking crisis that we have?
Yeah.
That's such a good question. And it actually brings me to like my next question. Maybe it's a statement. I don't even know how it's going to come out of my mouth, but it's going to come out eventually. but
it's going to get out.
Yeah. But with that,
gotta get it out.
With that being said, man, first of all, I want to shout out my basically sister-in-law, Tess Brandon. She has an organization called Seventh Well. It's actually an organization in Tennessee, in Chattanooga, that fights sexual trafficking. So I do want to say that real quick. So like, that's one place I could think of off the top of my head, but let's say you're listening right now. People are listening, like they hadn't really thought about like giving, they hadn't really thought about supporting to, an organization that kind of like stops some of these things, or like tries to do preventative actions. What kind of advice would you give them? What organizations would you speak of?
Yeah. So definitely sister-in-law?
It's my wife's best friend. So,
okay.
So to me, she's my sister-in-law. Like, yeah.
Like sister-in-law.
There you go.
Yeah.
Definitely her organization, Restore Core. We actually have a 5K, 10K coming up.
Okay.
That is free, and that you can give donations to help services here for victims.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery Tennessee is our partner agency in Nashville, and then Grow Free is also in Chattanooga, and they're kind of our East Tennessee partner agency.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also say too, like, if there is, you know, the foster care crisis is real.
Mm-hmm.
If you know somebody that is fostering, you know, I think, what do they need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, cause that is one of our most vulnerable populations. You're a school counselor, you know, mm-hmm. like I think asking you, like, what are your kids lacking that they need that they might, potentially end up being victims of human trafficking for?
Yeah.
So I think right. a lot of people think that they have to do high level stuff, like they have to like be vigilantes, right? Or they have to have all this money. And it's, you know, sometimes it's just a cup of coffee. Mm. It can be so multi-dimensional and how you really give back and break these cycles.
So what you're saying is that you can do something as simple as mentoring that's free. Don't cost you a dime. You can mentor somebody. Okay.
Be a mentor.
Yeah. Cool. Ron is literally wearing a shirt that says "I am a mentor." I don't know if he got it from.
Hey.
I don't know if he got it from Goodwill or nothing, but we gonna give him a benefit of the doubt today.
No, I am a mentor, sir. Okay. Yes, and I love the thought of being a Naomi. I like that. I think that should be a thing. That should be like
that's
a saying.
So awesome.
Be a Naomi today. You know, go to restorecorps.org. That's RestoreCorps.org and WhitneyTrotter.com. Check out the things Whitney got going on. We would definitely appreciate having you on the show, Whitney.
Yeah.
Yay.
This has been good.
Thank y'all for having me.
Yeah, I know we said 30 minutes, but you know,
we had to push it.
46 minutes in.
46 minutes later.
Yeah, man. But and Whitney, if you could potentially like email us some of those links, we will put them in the show notes. So like to places to give, places to support or whatever, we can definitely put them in the show notes. Tess, I got you. I'm gonna put Seventh Well in the show notes. So I'm gonna put that in there myself. But you know, think about it, really pray about this and think about like the ways that like this impacts the church. I think Whitney said it best when she said that, like, she essentially said it's embedded into the DNA of this country. And also in the church, it's embedded into the church's DNA to not talk about sex. So how those two things be happening at the same time can really lead to something crazy happening that should not be happening in a country that can freely express its religion. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, man. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up and, give them the Instagrams and all that stuff, Darius. Go ahead. You know what to say.
Yeah, man. If y'all want to follow us on Instagram, man, please do so at Unconformed Podcast, Unconformed Podcast. If you want to follow us on YouTube, also follow us on YouTube at Unconformed Podcast. If you want to follow us on Facebook, follow us on Facebook at, you guessed it, at Unconformed Podcast. Not very hard to do. And it's also in the show notes. All these links are in the show notes. And if you could, if you've enjoyed this episode, if you enjoy what we do, also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts as well as Spotify Podcasts. So you 3% that listen on Spotify, we need your 5 stars. We need the 5 stars ASAP.
We sure do. And check us out on YouTube. I don't know if this is going to be on YouTube. We got to pray about it.
Yeah.
And be a Naomi, man. Be a Naomi. That's all I'm going to say.
Big facts. Naomi. Big Naomi energy, man. BNE. Big Naomi energy.
On that note.
For Unconformed Podcast, I am Darius Watkins.
Yep, I'm Ryan Thomas.
Hey, and we out.